came to your father, and he brought Dustfinger back.
Yes, that was all that interested him, and all that ever would. Jasper had let sealing wax drop onto the parchment, and Mo pressed his stamp on it, the one he'd carved for the Book of Risa's drawings. A unicorn's head. The bookbinder's seal for the robber's promise. Mo gave Dustfinger the letter, exchanged a few words with Risa and the Black Prince, and came over to Meggie. When she was still so small that she stood no higher than his elbow, she would often push her head under his arm when something scared her. But that was long ago.
"What does death look like, Mo?" she had asked. "Did you really see death himself?"
The memory didn't seem to frighten him, but his eyes had immediately wandered far, far away. "Death has many shapes, but the voice of a woman."
"A woman?" Meggie had asked in surprise. "But Fenolio would never give a woman such a big part in his story."
And Mo had laughed and replied, "I don't think it was Fenolio who wrote Death's part, Meggie." She wouldn't look up at him when he stopped in front of her. "Meggie." He put his hand under her chin so that she had to meet his eyes. "Don't look so sad. Please." Behind him, the Black Prince took Batista and Doria aside. She could imagine what instructions he had for them. He was sending them to Umbra to spread the news among the desperate mothers there that the Blue Jay would not let down their stolen children. But what about his own daughter? Meggie thought, and was sure that Mo saw the accusation in her eyes. Without a word, he took her hand and drew her away from the tents, away from the robbers, and away from Risa, who was still standing by the fire. She was wiping the ink from her fingers, wiping and wiping, while Jasper watched sympathetically. It was as if she were trying to wipe away the words she had written. Mo stopped under one of the oak trees. Their branches stretched above the camp like a sky made of wood and yellowing leaves. He held Meggie's hand and ran his forefinger over it, as if he were surprised to find how large it was now. Yet her hands were still so much slimmer than his. A girl's hands.
"The piper will kill you."
"No, he won't. But if he tries, I'll be happy to show him how sharp a bookbinder's knife is. Batista is going to sew me a place to hide a knife again, and believe me, I'll be very happy if that child murderer gives me an opportunity to try it out on him." Hatred fell over his face like a shadow. The Blue Jay.
"The knife won't be any help. He'll kill you just the same."
She sounded stupid, like a defiant child. But she was so afraid for him. "Three children are dead, Meggie. Go to Doria and ask him to tell you again how they herded them together. They'll kill them all if the Blue Jay doesn't give himself up." The Blue Jay. He sounded as if he meant someone else. How dim did he think she was?
"It's not your story, Mo. Let the Black Prince save the children."
"How? The piper will kill them all if he tries." There was so much fury in his eyes. And for the first time, Meggie realized that Mo wasn't riding to the castle only to save the living children, but also to avenge the dead. That idea frightened her even more.
"Yes, I see. Perhaps you're right. Perhaps there really isn't any other way," she said. "But at least let me come with you, so that I can help you, like in the Castle of Night."
It seemed only yesterday that Firefox had pushed her into Mo's cell. Had he forgotten how glad he'd been to have her with him? Had he forgotten that it was she, with some help from Fenolio, who had saved him? No, she was sure he hadn't. But Meggie had only to look at him to know that in spite of everything, he would go alone this time. All alone. "Do you remember the robber stories I used to tell you?" he asked.
"Of course. They all end badly."
"And why? It's always the same. Because the robber wants to protect someone he loves, and they kill him for that. Right?" Oh, he was so clever. Had he said the same thing to her mother? "But I know him better than Risa," thought Meggie, "and I know far more stories than she does."
"What about the Highwayman poem?" she asked.
Eleanor had read it to her countless times. She could still hear her sighing.
"Oh, Meggie, why don't you read it aloud for a change? We don't have to mention it to your father. but I just love to see that highwayman galloping through my house.
Mo smoothed the hair back from her forehead. What about it?
The girl he loves warns him about the soldiers, and he escapes. Daughters can do that kind of thing, too.
Yes, indeed. Daughters are very good at rescuing their fathers. No one knows that better than me. He had to smile. She loved his smile. Suppose she never saw it again. But don't you remember how the poem ends for the girl, too? He added. Of course, Maggie remembered. Her musket shattered the moonlight, shattered her breast in the moonlight. And in the end, the soldiers killed the highwayman after all. And he lay in his blood on the highway, with the bunch of lace at his throat.
Maggie.
She turned her back to him. She didn't want to look at him anymore. She didn't want to feel afraid for him anymore. She simply wanted to be angry with him, that was all. Just as she was angry with Fareed, angry with Risa. Loving someone merely meant pain, nothing but pain.
Maggie.
Mo took her shoulders and turned her around. Suppose I don't ride to Umbra. How would you like the song they'd sing then? And one morning the blue jay disappeared and was never seen again? But the children of Umbra died on the other side of the forest like their fathers, and the adderhead reigned for all eternity because of the white book that the blue jay had bound for him. Yes, he was right. That was a terrible song. Yet Maggie knew one that would be even worse. But the blue jay rode to the castle to save the children of Umbra and died there. And although the fire dancer wrote his name in the sky with fiery letters so that the stars whisper it every night, his daughter never saw him again. That was how it would turn out, yes. But Mo was listening to a different song.
Fenolio is not going to write us a happy ending this time, Maggie, he said. I'll have to write it myself, but with actions instead of words. Only the blue jay can save the children. Only he can write the three words in the white book.
She still didn't look at him. She didn't want to hear what he was saying. But Mo went on in the voice she loved so much, the voice that had sung her to sleep, comforted her when she was sick, and told her stories about the mother who had disappeared.
I just want you to promise me something, he said. You and your mother must look after each other while I'm gone. The two of you can't go back. There's no trusting Orpheus's words. But the prince will protect you, and so will the strong man. He's promised me, on his brother's life, and he's certainly a much better protector than I am. Do you hear, Maggie? Whatever happens, stay with the robbers. Don't go to Umbra, and don't follow me to the Castle of Night if they take me there. I wouldn't be able to think straight if I found out that you two were in danger. Promise me.
Maggie bowed her head so that he wouldn't read her answer in her eyes. No, she wasn't going to make him any promises. And she was sure Risa hadn't either. Or had she? Maggie glanced over at her mother. She looked terribly sad. The strong man was beside her.
Unlike Maggie, he had forgiven Risa once Mo had come back safe and sound. Maggie, please listen to me.
Usually Mo began making jokes when he thought the mood was getting too serious, but obviously that had changed too. His voice sounded as serious and down-to-earth as if he were discussing a school trip with her.
If I don't come back, he said, you must get Fenolio to write words to take you and your mother home to Eleanor in our old world. He can't have forgotten how to do it entirely, after all. Then you can read his words and take the three of you back, you and Risa, and your brother.
Brother, I want a sister.
Ah, do you? Now he was smiling after all. Good. I want another daughter, too. My first has grown too big to be picked up in my arms.
They looked at each other, and there were so many words that Maggie wanted to say, but not one that really expressed what she was feeling. Who's going to take the letter to the castle? She asked quietly.
We don't know yet, replied Mo. It won't be easy to find someone who'll be allowed access to Violante.
3 days to go from the time her ugliness would get the letter, and the piper would accept the terms. Maggie hugged him as hard as she used to when she was a small child.
Please, Mo, she said softly, don't go. Please, let's all go back. Risa was right.
Go back, Meggie. Go back now, just when it's getting exciting, he whispered to her. So he hadn't changed so very much after all. He still cracked jokes when he thought things were getting too serious. She loved him so much. Mo took her face between his hands. He looked at her as if he were going to say something to her, and for a moment Meggie thought she read in his eyes that he was as frightened for her sake as she was for his. Believe me, Meggie, he said, I'm also riding to that castle to protect you. Some day you'll understand that. Didn't the two of us already know in the Castle of Night that I was binding the white book for the Adderhead only to write those three words in it sometime in the future? Meggie shook her head so hard that Mo hugged her again. Yes, Meggie, he said quietly. Yes, we did. Chapter 32 At Last. Darius read wonderfully, although in his mouth the words sounded very different from the way Mortimer would have read them, and of course very different again from the voice of Orpheus, that defiler of books. Perhaps Darius's art was most like Meggie's. He read with the innocence of a child, and it seemed to Eleanor as if for the first time she saw the boy he had once been. A thin, bespectacled boy who loved books as passionately as she did, but with the difference that for him the pages came to life. Darius's voice was not as full and beautiful as Mortimer's, nor did it have the enthusiasm that lent Orpheus's voice its power. No, Darius took the words on his tongue as carefully as if they might break apart there, might lose their meaning if they were spoken in too loud and firm a tone. All the sadness of the world lay in Darius's voice. The magic of the weak, the quiet and cautious, and their knowledge of the pitiless minds of the strong. The music of Orpheus's words amazed Eleanor as much as on the day she'd first heard him read them. Those words didn't sound at all like the work of the vain fool who had thrown her books at the library walls. Well, that's because he stole them from someone else, thought Eleanor, and then she thought of nothing more at all. Darius's tongue didn't stumble once. Perhaps because this time not fear, but love made him read. He opened the door between the letters on the page so gently that Eleanor felt as if they were stealing into Fenolio's world like two children slipping into a forbidden room. When she suddenly found a wall behind her, she dared not believe what her fingers were feeling. At first you think it's a dream. Wasn't that how Risa had described it? Well, if this is a dream, thought Eleanor, then I never intend to wake up. Her eyes greedily drank in the images suddenly flooding in on her. A square, a well, houses leaning against each other as if they were too old to stand up straight. Women in long dresses, most of them very shabby. A flock of sparrows, pigeons, two thin cats. A cart and an old man shoveling garbage into it. Heavens above, the stench was almost unbearable. But all the same, Eleanor breathed it in deeply. Ombra. She was in Ombra. What else could her surroundings be? A woman, drawing water at the well, turned and looked suspiciously at the heavy, dark red velvet dress Eleanor was wearing. Oh, drat it! She had rented the dress from a theatrical costume agency, along with the tunic Darius was wearing. She'd asked for something medieval. And now here she stood, looking as conspicuous as a peacock among a flock of crows. Never mind, you're here, Eleanor. When something pulled her hair rather roughly, tears of joy came to her eyes. With a practiced move, she caught the fairy who was about to make off with a grey strand of it. How she'd missed those tiny, fluttering creatures. But hadn't they been blue? This one shimmered in all the iridescent colours of a soap bubble. Captivated, Eleanor closed her hands around her catch and examined the fairy through her fingers. The little creature looked rather sleepy. This was wonderful. When the tiny teeth dug into her thumb and the fairy escaped, Eleanor laughed out loud, making two women poke their heads out of the nearby windows. Eleanor. She clapped her hand to her mouth, but she could still feel laughter like sherbet powder fizzing on her tongue. Oh, she was so happy, so idiotically happy. She hadn't felt like this since she was 6 years old and stole into her father's library to get at the books because he wouldn't let her read. "Perhaps you ought to drop dead here and now, Eleanor," she told herself. "At this very moment, how can things get any better?" Two men in colourful garments were crossing the square, strolling players. They didn't look quite as romantic as Eleanor had imagined the motley folk, but never mind. They were minstrels, and a brownie was carrying their instruments. His hairy face looked so bemused when he saw her that Eleanor instinctively felt her nose. Had something happened to her face? No, surely her nose had always been that size, hadn't it?
Eleanor!
She turned. Darius! For heaven's sake, she'd completely forgotten him. What was he doing under the rubbish cart? Looking bewildered, he crawled out from between the wooden wheels and plucked a few not very clean blades of straw off his tunic. Oh, Darius, of all the places in the Inkworld, he had to land under a load of garbage. Just like him. He was a walking disaster area, and the way he was looking around him, as if he'd fallen among thieves, poor Darius. Wonderful Darius. He was still holding the sheet of paper with Orpheus's words on it. But where was the bag with all the things they'd meant to bring? Just a moment, Eleanor, you were going to bring it. She looked around, and instead of the bag, saw Cerberus beside her, snuffling at the strange paving stones with great interest.
He'd have starved to death if we'd left him behind, stuttered Darius, still brushing straw off his tunic. Anyway, I suppose he can lead us to his master, and maybe he'll know where we can find the others.
Not a bad idea, Eleanor told herself. I'd never have thought of that. But what was making him stammer again?
Darius, you did it, she whispered,
hugging him so hard that his glasses slipped.
Thank you so much.
Hey, you there, where'd that dog come from?
Cerberus pressed close to Eleanor's legs, growling. Two soldiers were facing them. The soldiers are worse than the highwaymen. Hadn't Risa told her that, too? Most of them will kill for fun, sometime or other. Involuntarily, Eleanor took a step back, but she just came up against the wall of the house behind her.
Well, cat got your tongues?
One of the men punched Darius in the belly with his gloved fist, so hard that he doubled up.
What do you think you're doing? Leave him alone!
Eleanor's voice didn't sound half as fearless as she had hoped.
That's my dog.
Yours?
The soldier approaching her had only one eye. Fascinated, Eleanor stared at the place where the other eye had once been.
Only princesses may keep dogs. Trying to tell me you're a princess?
He drew his sword and ran the blade over Eleanor's dress.
And what sort of clothes are those? You think they make you look like a fine lady? What seamstress made that dress? She ought to be put in the pillory, so she ought.
The other soldier laughed.
The strolling players wear such garments, he said. She's a minstrel woman, rather past her prime.
A minstrel woman? Nah, too ugly for that.
The one-eyed man scrutinized Eleanor as if he were about to strip off her dress. She longed to tell him what she thought of his own appearance, but Darius cast her a pleading glance, and the point of the sword pressed menacingly against her stomach, as if the one-eyed soldier was thinking of boring a second navel in it.
Look down, Eleanor. Remember what Risa said. Women keep their eyes lowered in this world.
Please.
With difficulty, Darius scrambled to his feet.
We're strangers here. We come from far away.
And you come to Umbra? The soldiers laughed. By the Adderhead Silver, who'd come here of his own free will?
The one-eyed man was staring at Darius.
Take a look at this, he said, lifting off his glasses. He's got the same kind of frame thing as Four Eyes, the fellow that got the unicorn and the dwarf for the milksop.
Making a big performance of it, he perched the glasses on his own nose.
Hey! Take that off!
The other man uneasily retreated. The one-eyed soldier blinked at him through one thick lens and grinned.
I can see all your lies, all your black lies.
Laughing, he threw the glasses at Darius's feet.
Wherever you come from,
he said, reaching out for Cerberus's collar,
You're going back without any dog. Dogs belong to princes. This one's an ugly brute, but the milksop will like it all the same.
Cerberus bit the gloved hand so hard that the soldier screamed and fell to his knees. The other man drew his sword, but Orpheus's dog wasn't half as stupid as he was ugly. With the soldier's glove still in his jaws, he turned and ran for his life.
Quick, Eleanor!
Darius swiftly snatched up his twisted glasses and dragged her away with him, while the soldiers, cursing, stumbled off in pursuit of the hellhound. Eleanor couldn't remember when she had last run so fast, and even if her heart still felt like a young girl's, her legs were the legs of a rather too stout old woman. Eleanor, this was not the way you imagined your first hours in Umbra, she told herself as she followed Darius down an alley so narrow that she was afraid of getting stuck between the houses. But even if her feet hurt, and she could still feel the tip of that one-eyed oaf's sword in her stomach, never mind. She was in Umbra. At last she was behind the letters on the page. That was all that mattered. And it was hardly to be expected that life would be as tranquil here as in her house at home, leaving aside the fact that recently it hadn't been so tranquil there either. Well, never mind that. She was here. She was here, at last, in the only story with an ending that she really wanted to know, because all the people she loved were in it. But it's a pity the dog has gone, she thought, as Darius stopped at the end of the alley, unsure which way to go. Cerberus's ugly nose would have come in very useful in this maze of alleyways, and she was probably going to miss him, too. Risa, Meggie, Mortimer. She felt like shouting their names through the streets. Where are you? I'm here. I'm here at last. But perhaps they're not here anymore, Eleanor, a voice inside her whispered, while the strange sky above them grew dark. Perhaps the three of them died long ago. Hush, she thought. Hush, Eleanor. That thought wasn't allowed. It simply was not allowed.
Chapter 33. Herbs for Her Ugliness. Several times a day, Violante went down to the dungeons where the milksop had imprisoned the children. She always brought along two maids who were still loyal to her, and one of the boys who served her as soldiers. Child soldiers, the piper called them, but her father had made sure that these boys weren't children anymore, when he had their fathers and brothers slaughtered in the Wayless Wood. And the children in the dungeon soon wouldn't be children either. Fear was making them grow up fast. The mothers stood outside the castle, begging the guards at least to let them go in to see their youngest children. They brought clothes, dolls, food, in the hope that at least some of it might end up in the hands of their sons and daughters. But the guards threw most of these things away, although Violante kept sending her maids to them to collect what the mothers had brought. Fortunately, the piper did at least allow her to do that. Fooling the milksop was easy. He was even more stupid than his doll-like sister, and had never realized how Violante was spinning her web behind his back. But the piper was clever, and only two things made it possible to manipulate him. His fear of the adderhead, and his vanity. Violante had flattered the piper from the day he first rode into Umbra. She acted as if she were glad he had come, saying she was tired of the milksop's feeble stupidity. She told the piper how he squandered money, and commissioned Balbulus to write out the piper's dark songs on his best parchment, and illuminate them, even though the commission made Balbulus so furious that he broke three of his most valuable brushes before her eyes. After Sootbird had lured the children into the trap on the piper's orders, Violante had praised the silver-nosed man for his wiliness, and was sick in her bedchamber later. Nor did she let him see that these days she couldn't sleep, because she thought she heard the children crying in the dungeons by night. She wasn't letting him know that. She had been just four herself, when her father had her and her mother shut up in the old chamber in the castle of night. But her mother had taught her to hold her head high all the same.
"You've a man's heart, Violante," her father-in-law had once told her. Sad, stupid old man. To this day she didn't know if he had been paying her a compliment or expressing disapproval.
She knew only that all the things she most wanted belonged to men. Freedom, knowledge, strength, cleverness, power. Was the thirst for revenge masculine too? Or a wish to rule, or impatience with others? She'd inherited all those from her father. Her ugliness. Her disfiguring birthmark had faded, but the name stuck. It was part of her, like a very pale face and ridiculously slight body.
Her slyness, that's what they ought to call you, Balbulus sometimes said.
No one knew her better than Balbulus. No one saw through her more clearly. And Violante knew that whenever Balbulus hid a fox in one of his pictures, he meant her. Her slyness. She was certainly crafty. The sight of the piper made her physically ill, but she smiled at him as she had learned to do from watching her father, with condescension mingled with a touch of cruelty. She wore shoes that made her look taller. Violante had always hated being so short, but she did nothing to make her face prettier, since it was her opinion that beautiful women might be desired, but were never respected, certainly not feared. Anyway, she would have felt ridiculous with her lips painted red, or her brows plucked to a narrow arch. Some of the child prisoners were injured. The piper had allowed Violante to send the barn owl to tend them, but there was no persuading him to let them go.
"Not until we've caught our bird," he had replied to her request. "They're here as bait for him."
And Violante had seen it in her mind's eye. She saw them dragging the blue jay to the castle once the mothers weeping down there outside the gates had given him away. He was bleeding like the unicorn that the milksop had killed in the forest. That image remained with her, even clearer than the pictures that Balbulus painted. But in her dreams, she saw another. In that one, the blue jay killed her father and set a crown on her head, on her mouse-brown hair.
"The blue jay will soon be a dead man," Balbulus had said to her only yesterday. "I hope he'll at least ensure that his death makes a good picture."
Violante could have struck him in the face, but her anger had never yet impressed him.
"Take care, your ugliness," he had murmured to her. "You're always giving your love to the wrong men. But at least the last one had blue blood."
She should have had his tongue cut out for such impertinence. Her father would have done it on the spot. But then who would tell her the truth, much as it might hurt? Brianna used to, but Brianna had gone. Outside, the second night was falling on the children in the dungeons, and Violante had just asked one of her maids to bring her hot wine, hoping that for a few hours it would at least make her forget those little faces, the small hands clutching her skirt, when Vito entered her room.
"Your Highness."
The boy was just 15, and the oldest of her soldiers, the son of a smith. A dead smith, of course.
"Your former maidservant is at the gate. Brianna, that woman healer's daughter."
Tullio cast Violante a doubtful glance. He had wept when she had turned Brianna out. For that she wouldn't allow him to come to her room for more than 2 days. Brianna. Had Violante's own thoughts summoned her? The name still sounded so comforting. She'd probably spoken it more often than her sons. Why was her silly heart beating faster? Had it already forgotten how much pain the girl had caused it? Her father was right. The heart was a weak, changeable thing, bent on nothing but love, and there could be no more fatal mistake than to make it your master. Reason must be in charge. It comforted you for the heart's foolishness. It sang mocking songs about love, derided it as a whim of nature, transient as flowers. So why did she still keep following her heart? It was her heart that leaped up at the sound of Brianna's name, while her reason asked, what does she want here? Does she miss her comfortable life? Is she tired of being a maid, scrubbing floors for Four Eyes, who bows so low to the milksop that his chin almost collides with his plump knees? Or is she going to beg me to let her go down into the vault to kiss my dead husband's mouth?
Brianna says she's bringing herbs from her mother for the children in the dungeon, but she'll give them only to you in person.
Tullio looked pleadingly at her. He had no pride, but a loyal heart. Too loyal. Yesterday, a few of the milksop's friends had shut him in the dog pens with the hounds again. Her own son had been with them.
Good. Go and bring her in, Tullio.
Your voice can give you away, but Violante knew how to make hers sound indifferent. Only once had she shown what she really felt when Cosimo had come back, and then she felt all the more ashamed to find that he preferred her maidservant to her. Brianna. Tullio shot eagerly off, and Violante patted her hair, which was severely pinned back, and looked dubiously at her dress and the jewels she was wearing. Brianna had that effect on people. She was so beautiful that everyone felt clumsy and colourless in her presence. Violante had once liked that. She had hidden behind Brianna's beauty, relishing the fact that her maid made others feel as she herself always did. Ugly. It had pleased her that so much beauty served her, admired her, perhaps even loved her. Tullio was smiling foolishly all over his furry face as he came back with Brianna. She hesitated as she entered the room where she had spent so many hours. It was said that she wore a coin with Cosimo's picture around her neck, and kissed it so often that by now the face could hardly be made out. But grief had only made her more beautiful. How could that be? How could there be any justice in the world if even beauty wasn't granted to all? Brianna sank down in a low curtsy. No one could do it more charmingly, and handed Violante a basket full of herbs.
My mother has heard from the barn owl that some of the children are hurt and many won't eat. These herbs may help. She has written to tell you how they work and how they must be given.
Brianna took a sealed letter out from under the leaves, handing it to Violante with another curtsy.
A seal for a healer's instructions.
Violante sent away the maid who was busy turning back her bed, she didn't trust the girl, and picked up her new reading glasses. The same glazier who had made a new frame for the glasses worn by Four Eyes, a gold frame, of course, had made hers. She had paid him with her last ring. The glasses did not reveal lies to her, as it was said those that Four Eyes wore did. Balbulus's lettering was not much clearer than when seen through the beryl she normally used. But at least the world wasn't red anymore, and she could see better with both eyes at once, even though she couldn't wear the glasses for too long without straining her eyes.
You read too much, Balbulus was always saying, but what was she to do? Without words, she would die. She'd simply die, even faster than her mother had done.
Violante broke it, and instinctively glanced at the door when she realized who had written to her. Brianna followed her glance. She had lived in this castle long enough to know that the walls and doors had ears, but fortunately, written words made no sound. Nonetheless, Violante felt as if she could hear the blue jay's voice as she read, and she understood exactly what he was telling her, even if he had hidden his real words behind the written ones with great skill. The written words spoke of the children and how the blue jay was giving himself up in exchange for their freedom. They promised her father that the white book would be cured if the piper let the children go. But the hidden words said something else, something that only she could read between the lines. They said that at last the blue jay was ready to strike the bargain she had offered him beside Cosimo's coffin. He would help her to kill her father.
We can do it easily together.
Could they really? She lowered the letter. What had she been thinking when she made that promise? She sensed Brianna's eyes on her and abruptly turned her back to the girl. Think, Violante. She pictured what would happen step by step, image by image, as if leafing through one of Balbulus's books. Her father would come to Umbra as soon as the Blue Jay had given himself up, that much was certain. After all, he still hoped that the man who had bound the white book for him could cure its ills. And as he trusted no one else with the book, he would have to bring it to the Blue Jay himself. Of course, her father would come, with the intention of killing the jay. He was desperate, half crazed with what the rotting pages were doing to him, and even on the journey, he would be thinking how to put his enemy to death in the most painful possible way. But first he must hand the book over to that enemy. And as soon as the Blue Jay had the white book in his hands, it would all depend on her. How much time does it take to write 3 words? She must gain him that time. Just 3 words. A few seconds when he was unobserved, a pen and some ink, and then not the Blue Jay, but her father would die, and Ombra would be hers. Violante felt her breath coming fast, her own blood roaring in her ears. Yes, it could work. But it was a dangerous plan, and far more dangerous for the Blue Jay than for her. Nonsense, it will work, said her reason, her cool reason. But her heart was beating so fast that she felt dizzy. Once he's in the castle, her reason kept asking, how are you going to protect him? What about the piper and the milksop?
Your Highness?
Brianna's voice sounded different, as if something in her had broken. Good. I hope she sleeps badly, thought Violante. I hope her beauty fades while she's on her knees scrubbing floors. But when she turned and looked at Brianna, all she wanted was to hold her close and laugh with her again, the way they used to laugh.
There's something else I'm to tell you.
Brianna didn't lower her eyes when she looked at Violante. She was still as proud as ever.
These herbs will taste very bitter. They will help only if you use them properly. In the worst case, they can even be deadly. It's all up to you.
As if she had to have that explained to her. But Brianna was still looking at her. Protect him, said her eyes. If you don't, then all is lost. Violante stood up straight as a ramrod.
I understand you very well, she said brusquely. I am sure that the children will be very much better in 3 days' time. Their troubles will be over, and I'll use the herbs with all the necessary care. Take that message back. And now go. Tullio will escort you back to the gates.
Brianna sank into another curtsy.
Thank you. I know they'll be in the best of hands with you.
She rose hesitantly.
I know you have plenty of maids, she added quietly. But if you ever want my company again, please send for me. I miss you.
She uttered the last words so softly that Violante could hardly hear them.
I miss you too.
The words were on the tip of Violante's tongue, but she didn't let them pass her lips. Be quiet, heart, you stupid, forgetful thing.
Thank you, she said. But I don't feel like hearing songs at present.
No, of course not. Brianna turned as pale as when Violante had hit her, after she had been with Cosimo and then lied to Violante about it.
But who's reading to you? Who's playing with Jacopo? I'm reading to myself.
Violante was proud of the cold rejection in her voice, although her heart felt so differently.
As for Jacopo, I don't see much of him. He goes around wearing a tin nose that he had the smith make him. He sits on the piper's knee, and he tells everyone he'd never have been stupid enough to let Sootbird entice him into the marketplace.
Brianna put her hand to her throat. She really did wear a coin there.
Do you sometimes see him, too? See who? Cosimo. I see him every night in my dreams. And in the day, I sometimes feel as if he was standing behind me.
Stupid creature, in love with a dead man. What did she still love about him? His beauty was food for worms now. And what else was there in Cosimo for anyone to love? No, Violante had buried her love with him. It had gone away like the silly happiness you feel after a jug of wine.
Would you like to go down to the vault?
Violante couldn't believe that her mouth had uttered those words. Brianna was looking at her incredulously.
Tullio will take you down, but don't expect too much. You'll find no one but the dead there. Tell me, Brianna, she added.
Ugly Violante, cruel Violante.
Were you disappointed when the Blue Jay brought your father and not Cosimo back from the dead?
Brianna bent her head. Violante had never been able to find out whether she loved her father or not.
I would very much like to go down to the vault, she said quietly. If you'll allow me.
Violante nodded to Tullio, and he took Brianna's hand.
3 more days, and everything will be all right, said Violante when Brianna was at the door. Injustice is not immortal, it can't be.
Brianna nodded, as abstractedly as if she hadn't been listening.
"Send for me," she said again.
Then she was gone, and Violante was already missing her as the door closed. "So," she thought, "is there any feeling you understand better? Losing people and missing them, that's what your life consists of." She folded up the Blue Jay's letter and went over to the tapestry that had hung in her bedchamber since she first slept there at the age of 7. It showed a unicorn hunt, woven in a time when unicorns had been creatures of fantasy and were not carried dead through Umbra after a hunt. But even the unicorns of fantasy had had to die. Innocence doesn't live long in any world. Ever since Violante had met the Blue Jay, the unicorn had reminded her of him. She had seen the same innocence in his face. How are you going to protect him, Violante? How? Wasn't it the same in all the stories? Women didn't protect the unicorns. They brought them to their death. The guards at her door looked tired, but they hastily straightened their backs when she came out. Child soldiers. They both had small siblings down in the dungeon.
"Wake the piper," she told them. "Tell him I have important news for my father."
Her father. The word never failed to take effect, but none tasted more unpleasant to her. Just 6 letters, and she felt small and weak and so ugly that people avoided looking at her. She remembered her 7th birthday only too well. It was the only day when her father had obviously been happy to have such an unattractive child.
"A good revenge," he had told her mother, "giving my ugliest daughter to my enemy's handsome son for his wife." Father.
When would there be no one she had to call father anymore? She pressed the Blue Jay's letter to her heart. Soon. Chapter 34. Burnt Words. They were setting off at sunrise. The piper had accepted Mo's conditions. The children of Umbra would be set free as soon as the Blue Jay kept his promise and handed himself over to the Adderhead's daughter. Some of the robbers were going to disguise themselves as women and wait outside the castle with the mothers, and Dustfinger would accompany Mo to Umbra as a fiery warning to the piper. But the Blue Jay would ride into the castle alone.
"Don't call him that, Meggy," she told herself.
There were only a few hours now until dawn. The Black Prince was sitting by the fire, wide awake, with Batista and Dustfinger, who didn't appear to need any sleep at all now that he was back from the dead. Farid was sitting beside him, of course, and Roxanne. But Dustfinger's daughter had moved into Umbra Castle. Violante had taken Brianna back on the morning when the piper had announced his agreement with the Blue Jay. Mo wasn't sitting by the fire with them. He had gone to lie down and get some sleep, and Risa was with him. How could he sleep tonight? The strong man was sitting outside the tent, as if he must at least keep watch over the Blue Jay.
"You should sleep too, Meggy," Mo had told her,
when he saw her sitting a little way from the others under the trees. But Meggy had only shaken her head. It was rainy, and her clothes were as damp and chilly as her hair, but it wasn't much better inside the tents, and she didn't want to lie there with the rain telling her how the piper would greet her father. "Meggy." Doria sat down in the wet grass beside her. His hair was wavy from the rain. "Are you riding to Umbra too?" She nodded. Farid glanced at them.
"I'll steal into the castle as soon as your father has ridden through the door, I promise you," said Doria. "And Dustfinger will stay near the castle too. We'll protect him."
"What are you saying?" Meggy's voice sounded sharper than she had intended. "You can't protect him, not just the two of you. The piper will kill him. Are you thinking she's only a girl? Tell her lies to comfort her. I was with my father in the castle of night. I've faced the Adderhead. They'll kill him."
Doria did not reply. He stayed silent for a long time, and she felt sorry she'd snapped at him like that. She wanted to say so, but she too remained silent, her head bent so that he wouldn't see the tears she'd been holding back for hours. What he'd said had started them flowing, and now he'd be thinking, "She's a girl, she cries." She felt Doria's hand on her hair. He was stroking it as gently as if to wipe away the rain.
"He won't kill him," he whispered to her. "The piper is far too frightened of the Adderhead for that."
But he hates my father. Hate is sometimes stronger than fear, and if the piper doesn't kill him, then the milksop will do it, or the adderhead himself. He'll never get out of that castle alive, never.
How her hands were shaking, as if all her fear was in her fingers. But Doria clasped them so firmly in his own hands that they couldn't shake any more. He had strong hands, although his fingers weren't much longer than her own. Farid's hands were slender by comparison.
Farid says you saved your father once with words when he was wounded. He says you did it just with words.
Yes, but she had no words this time.
Words? What is it?
Doria let go of her hands and looked at her with a question in his eyes. Farid was still watching them, but Meggy ignored him. She planted a kiss on Doria's cheek.
Thank you, she said, quickly getting to her feet.
Of course he didn't understand what she was thanking him for. Words, the words that Orpheus had written. How could she have forgotten them? She ran through the wet grass to the tent where her parents were sleeping. Mo will be terribly angry, she thought, but he'll live. Hadn't she read what would happen next into this story more than once already? It was time to do it again, even if that meant it wouldn't end as Mo wanted. The Black Prince would just have to tell the rest of it. He'd find a way to make it turn out well, even without the Blue Jay's aid. For the Blue Jay must leave, before her father died with him. The strong man had nodded off. His head had sunk onto his chest, and he was snoring slightly as Meggy crept past him. Her mother was awake. She had been crying.
I need to talk to you, Meggy whispered to her. Please.
Mo was fast asleep. Risa cast a glance at his sleeping face and then followed Meggy outside. They still weren't speaking to each other very much. Meggy found it impossible to forget that night among the graves. Yet now she was about to do exactly what her mother had intended when she rode to Umbra in secret.
If it's about tomorrow, said Risa, taking her hand. Don't tell anyone, but I'm going to Umbra with them, even though your father doesn't want me to. I want at least to be near him when he rides into the castle.
He's not going to ride into the castle.
Rain was still falling through the fading leaves, as if the trees were shedding tears, and Meggy longed for Eleanor's garden. The rain sounded so peaceful there. Here it whispered of nothing but death and danger.
I'm going to read the words.
Dustfinger turned, and for a moment Meggy was afraid he could see in her face what she planned to do and tell Mo. But he turned away again and kissed Roxanne's black hair.
What words?
Risa looked at her blankly.
The words Orpheus wrote for you.
The words for which Mo almost died, she wanted to add. Now they would save his life. Risa looked back at the tent where Mo was sleeping.
I don't have them anymore, she said. I burned them when your father didn't come back.
No.
They couldn't have protected him anyway.
A glass man appeared among dripping wet nettles, pale green, like many of the glass men who still lived in the forest. He sneezed and scurried away in alarm at the sight of Meggy and Risa. Her mother placed her hands on Meggy's shoulders.
He didn't want to come with us, Meggy. He told Orpheus to write something just for us. Your father wants to stay even now, and neither you nor I can force him to go back. He'd never forgive us.
Risa tried to stroke her daughter's wet hair back from her forehead, but Meggy pushed her hand away. It couldn't be true. She was lying. Mo would never stay here without his wife and daughter.
Would he?
And perhaps he's right. Perhaps everything will turn out well, said her mother quietly. And one day we'll be telling Eleanor how your father saved the children of Umbra. Risa's voice didn't sound half as hopeful as her words.
Blue Jay,
she whispered, as she glanced at the men sitting by the fire. The first present your father ever gave me was a bookmark made of Blue Jay feathers. Isn't that strange? Meggy didn't answer, and Risa caressed her wet face once more and went back to the tent.
Burnt.
It was still dark, but a few freezing fairies were already beginning to dance. Mo would soon be setting out, and there was nothing that could stop him. Nothing. Batista was sitting alone between the roots of the great oak that the guards climbed at night. You could see almost as far as Umbra from its highest branches. he was making a new mask.
Meggy saw the blue feathers in his lap and knew who would soon be wearing it.
Batista.
Meggy kneeled down beside him. The ground was cold and damp, but the moss among the roots was as soft as the cushions in Eleanor's house.
He looked at her, his eyes full of sympathy. His glance was even more comforting than Doria's hands.
"Ah, the Blue Jay's daughter,"
he said in the voice that the strong man called Batista's marketplace voice.
"What a beautiful sight at such a dark hour. I've shown your father a good place to hide a sharp knife. Can a poor strolling player ease your heart in some other way?"
Meggy tried to smile. She was so tired of tears.
"Can you sing me a song?
One of the songs the Inkweaver wrote about the Blue Jay? It has to be one of those. The best you know. A song full of power and...
hope?" Batista smiled. "Of course, I could fancy such a song too.
Even if," he added, lowering his voice to a conspiratorial tone, "even if your father doesn't like having them sung when he's around. But I'll sing it so quietly that my voice won't wake him. Let's see, which is the right song for this dark night?"
He thoughtfully stroked the mask on his lap. It was nearly finished.
"Yes," he whispered at last. "I know."
And he began singing in a soft voice.
"Piper, beware, your end is near. The adder's power dwindles. He writhes, he goes in mortal fear. Nothing his strength rekindles. Though you seek the jay in country and town, no sword can wound him, no hound run him down. And when you think you'll succeed in your quest, you find that the bird has flown the nest."
Yes, those were the right words. Meggy got Batista to sing them to her until she could remember every line. Then she sat down a little way from everyone else under the trees where the firelight still kept the darkness of night away and wrote the song down in the notebook that Mo had bound for her long ago in that other life, after a quarrel that now seemed so strange.
"Meggy, you'll lose yourself in the ink world."
Didn't he say something like that to her at the time?
And now he himself didn't want to leave this world. He wanted to stay here alone without her.
Words written down in black and white. It was a long, long time since she'd read anything aloud. When did she last do it? When she brought Orpheus here? Don't think about that, Meggy. Think of the other times, the Castle of Night, the words that helped when Mo was wounded.
"Piper, beware. Your end is near."
Yes, she could still do it.
Meggy felt the words gathering weight on her tongue as she wove them into her surroundings.
"The adder's power dwindles. He writhes. He goes in mortal fear. Nothing his strength rekindles."
She sent the words to find Mo in his sleep, made him armor out of them, armor that even the piper and his dark master couldn't pierce.
"Though you seek the jay in country and town, no sword can wound him, no hound run him down. And when you think you'll succeed in your quest, you find that the bird has flown the nest."
Meggy read Fenolio's song over and over again, until the sun rose. Chapter 35. The Next Verse. It was a cold day, misty and colourless, and Umbra looked as if it were wearing a grey dress. The women had gone to the castle at daybreak, silent as the day itself, and now they were standing there and waiting without a word. There was not a cheerful sound to be heard, no laughter, no weeping. It was simply quiet. Risa stood with the mothers, as if she too were waiting for a child to come back, instead of expecting to lose her husband. Did the baby she was carrying under her aching heart sense its mother's despair this morning? Suppose it never saw its father. Had that thought ever made Mo hesitate? She hadn't asked him. Meggy stood beside her, her face under such rigid control that it frightened Risa more than if she had been crying. Doria was with her, dressed as a maidservant with a headscarf over his brown hair, because boys of his age were conspicuous in Umbra now. His brother hadn't come with them. All Batista's skill with disguises couldn't have made the strong man look like a woman, but more than a dozen robbers had been able to steal past the guards at the gate with their faces shaved, wearing stolen dresses and with scarves over their heads. Even Risa didn't notice them among all the women. The Black Prince had told his men to go to the mothers as soon as their children were free and persuade them to bring their sons and daughters to the forest the next day so that the robbers could hide them in case the piper broke his word and came to take them away to the mines after all. For who was going to ransom them the second time once the Blue Jay was caught? The Black Prince himself hadn't come to Umbra with them. His dark face would have attracted far too much attention. Snapper, who had opposed Mo's plan to the last, had also stayed in the camp, like Roxanne and Farid. Of course, Farid had wanted to go with the others, but Dustfinger had forbidden it. And after what had happened on Mount Adder, Farid did not go against such orders. Risa glanced at Meggy again. She knew that if she could find any comfort today, it would be only in her daughter. Meggy was grown up now. Risa realized that this morning. "I don't need anyone," said her face. It said so to Doria, who was still standing beside her, to her mother, and perhaps above all to her father. A whisper ran through the waiting crowd. Reinforcements joined the guards on the castle walls, and Violante appeared behind the battlements above the gates, so pale that it looked as if the rumours about her were true. The Adderhead's daughter, they said, almost never left her dead husband's castle. Risa had never seen her ugliness before. But of course she had heard of the mark that had disfigured her face like a brand since birth, and then faded on Cosimo's return. It was hardly visible now, but Risa noticed that Violante's hand instinctively went to her cheek when she saw all the women staring up at her. Her ugliness. Had they shouted that name up to her in the past, whenever she had appeared on the battlements? Some of the women were whispering it even now, but Violante was neither ugly nor beautiful. She held herself very erect, as if to make up for her lack of height, but between the two men who stationed themselves beside her, she looked so young and vulnerable that Risa felt fear close like a claw around her heart. The piper and the milksop. Violante looked like a child between the two of them. How was this girl to protect Mo? A boy pushed his way in beside the silver-nosed minstrel. He wore a metal nose, too, but there was a real flesh-and-blood nose under it. This must be Jacopo, Violante's son. Mo had mentioned him. He obviously thought more of the piper's company than his mother's, judging by the admiring looks he gave his grandfather's herald. Risa felt dizzy when she saw the man with the silver nose standing up there so proudly. No. Violante couldn't protect Mo from him. He commanded Umbra now, not she. And not the milksop, who stood looking down at his subjects as haughtily as if the mere sight of them turned his stomach. The piper, in contrast, seemed as pleased with himself as if the day belonged to him alone. Didn't I tell you so? His glance mocked them. I'll catch the Blue Jay, and then I'll take your children all the same. Why had she come? Why was she doing this to herself? Because she wanted to convince herself that it was all really happening? That she wasn't just reading about it? The woman next to her reached for her arm. He's coming, she whispered to Risa. There were whispers everywhere. He's coming. He's really coming. Risa saw the sentries on the watchtowers by the gate, giving the piper a signal. Of course he was coming. What had they expected? Did they think he wouldn't keep his word? The milksop adjusted his wig and smiled at the piper as triumphantly as if he personally, single-handed, had driven into his path the quarry he'd been hunting so long. But the piper ignored him. He was staring at the street leading up from the city gate, his eyes as grey as the sky above him, and just as cold. Risa remembered those eyes only too well. She also remembered the smile that now stole over his thin lips. He had smiled in just the same way in Capricorn's fortress whenever there was going to be an execution. And then she saw Mo. There he was, all of a sudden, where the street ended, mounted on the black horse that the prince had given him after he had to leave his own behind at Umbra Castle. The mask that Batista had made him was dangling around his neck,